Hello, hello, and welcome once again to Learning Digital Photography. I'm your host, Jason Anderson, and you're listening to episode number 33. On this week's show, we're going to be talking to you about the subject of how to create compelling captures in your images. And the reason why we're talking about this is because I had a great conversation with David Duschman earlier this week. I think actually it was last week, and we're putting the show together here for you. But the whole subject of how to create compelling captures came up, and he had a couple great suggestions for things to look at, things to consider when you go out and take your photos. A lot of great stuff coming up on this week's show. We've also got some listener questions and answers. We've got some contest news for you. So don't go away. We'll be back on this week's show on how to create compelling images right after this. Welcome back to Learning Digital Photography. We've got a really long interview with David Duschman this week, and I want to share that interview with you in its entirety. So I'm going to be kind of quick with the news for this week. There were a couple news items that I wanted to come talk to you about, at least briefly. One of them is this new Canon 70 firmware update that they're releasing. The camera just got released. It's created quite of a little brouhaha on the blogosphere and on the internets and whatnot. People are talking about the 70 just being released and already a firmware update to take care of some of these ghosting issues, apparently. So just to kind of give you a heads up, there is a firmware update for the Canon 70 for those of you that are buying it or already own it. If you want to go to the Canon website and get the latest firmware update for that. The other couple bits of imaging-related news, one comes to us from over in Montreal, the Montreal Gazette. I had an article that came out for this. Hani Farid, who is an expert in digital forensics at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire, has found a new way. The news post didn't give too much information, but it said he's found a new way to analyze photos using 3D imaging to analyze shadows and lines of light and perspectives and angles and things of that nature. And it's just really kind of interesting how we can take imaging software to actually analyze images and use them for forensics. So it's just kind of an interesting twist. I'll throw a link to that in the show notes. You can read the whole story there. He was actually looking at a photo of Lee Harvey Oswald that was alleged to be a forgery. He's saying, based on his analysis, it's actually not. This is the guy that supposedly shot JFK. The whole movie, I don't want to go into that. But it was a pretty interesting article from a photo perspective about how software is being used. The other two pieces of photo news I wanted to share were that the Droid just came out over on the Verizon network. This is supposedly going to be a competitor to the iPhone. And one thing that's cool is Adobe, who runs Photoshop.com, a website where you can actually edit your photos online, which has been available for the iPhone for a while, has now crossed over and made this application available for the Droid as well on the Verizon network. So that's something you may want to check out. I got this off the AP line from Wired.com, where they're talking about the announcement from Adobe. It's pretty exciting there. That happened just the other day. And the last thing I wanted to share with you was something I actually had mentioned on the blog just the other day about image theft, and I have to be really careful of it. And I'm not saying they stole it or anything, but a news article hit the wire about Toyota actually using a photo gallery that was pulled from Flickr in their online ads, and a couple avid Flickr users were monitoring it and made the announcement to other Flickr users. Eventually the ads got pulled. There's been created quite a bit of stir and controversy on that. So it's just kind of a reminder there. I'll throw a link to that news in the show notes as well. But it's kind of a reminder just to make sure that you're aware of that when you throw images on the internet, to do so with care and caution. Make sure you use low-res images. Make sure you qualify that they're copyright protected if you so choose, or that they're limited licensing, or whatever you're comfortable with. But that's just kind of a heads up there for that. We're going to get into the image or the interview here with David Duschman right after this. It's been an interesting week or two of news, and I don't really want to spend a lot of time focusing on that, because what's most exciting is this show, in this show where we're talking about how to create compelling captures. And we don't want to get caught up in the news, we don't want to get caught up in the technical too much, and I'm going to share with you one way in which you can create compelling images before we get into the interview, because it comes up. And it's the question of controversy, how to create controversy in your image. And it's kind of an interesting perspective that we take on this, because you can create controversy not only from where you're taking the image, but also from where the viewer is viewing your image. And it can be kind of subjective, and it's interesting when you look at that from both perspectives. Dave's got some great ideas on this and other ways in which you can create compelling images too. So you're going to want to hear what he has to say on that. That's coming up after the break, so don't go away. I'll be back in just a minute talking with David Duschman here at Learning Digital Photography. Learning Digital Photography. On the phone with me today, I have the renowned David Duschman. David Duschman is a travel photographer. He's got some great work. If you haven't heard of David Duschman and you're into photography, you're pretty much hiding in the cave, because he's pretty well known, well respected. David does a lot of workshops around the globe. I understand he's got coming one up in Italy next year. He's also got a lot of books on the market. One of his most recent that's been very well critically received is Within the Frame, which I'm looking at right now. And I'd like to just say, David, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Jason.
It's a lot of fun having you here. I'm excited to ask you a couple off-the-cuff questions. We're not going to be talking about gear so much and what f-stop you're shooting at and all that kind of thing. We're going to go a little different direction to make things more interesting for people. Now, you obviously hadn't heard the first part of the podcast, but the theme for this week is actually controversy and its impact on images in creating something that's synergistic, that's got a lot of energy. And I've noticed that in the later chapters of your book, you actually mention that in a fair detail when you do some references to Castro down in Cuba. And I noticed one shot later on where you also said you almost got shot for taking a picture of a girl somewhere. I'm forgetting where that was. I'm trying to find it now.
Well, it was in Ethiopia, and we'd been driving all day and got into an area of Ethiopia that was heavily Muslim, and that's neither here nor there, except that I didn't realize it, and so I wasn't picking up on the social cues that I should have been. So probably being a little engaging a little hyperbole to say I almost got shot, because no one knows whether that would have happened or not. But this woman peeked her head into this cafe that we were photographing in, and everyone was enjoying one another's company. So we were in this incredible little place in the middle of the desert, and we pulled into this little hole in the wall place. And I mean, it looked like it had been shot at a million times and nearly bombed out of existence. And yet you go into this little place, and there's this beautiful old World War, I assume a World War II era Italian coffee maker that just made the most extraordinary coffee in the world. Ethiopian coffee is fantastic. Anyway, we're sitting around, we're talking, and these Afar warriors come in from this particular tribe. These Afars, they come in, and they've got Kalashnikovs on their back and swords at their hip, and they come in, and they welcome us, and we all sit around and have coffee, and we're taking photographs, and this young Muslim woman sticks her head inside the door, and she too was actually quite enjoying our company. And I raised my camera up to take a couple pictures, and she was okay with it, which is, as long as a Muslim woman is okay with it and everyone else is all right with it, it's all right. You just gotta be very careful about the social codes that you're either conforming to or breaking.
Sure.
And so everyone was very aware of the situation until a police officer, who was late on the scene, assumed that I was taking photographs on the sly of this woman who was not looking at me, because frankly, I think she was bored of me and was watching these guys, with the guns and the swords, and just, she was just a bystander, and she'd grown bored of me and I was taking photographs, and this cop thought that I was trying to take illicit photographs of this young woman, and he got very agitated and started waving his gun around, at which point my guide suggested it would be the appropriate time to get in the vehicle and beat a hasty retreat.
You might want to stop taking pictures now. There's a Kalashnikov pointed at you. That's good.
I figured these guys were all enjoying our company. We had at least four Kalashnikovs on our side.
Right, if it comes down to a battle of Kalashnikovs, though, I don't think I want to
well, those
engage in that kind of repartee.
You know, those things are notoriously bad at aiming. So even whether he wasn't shooting at me particularly, I'm sure one of us would have got shot. So.
Anytime there's gunfire, I avoid that.
Yeah.
Almost exclusively. Well, the other thing that I thought was interesting in your book about the controversy, not so much controversy, but the controversial conditions in which you take pictures was your reference to Cuba. Because you said that later in your book, you were talking about like statues and caricatures of Castro and Guevara being all over the place down there.
Sure.
And that kind of goes counterintuitive to what we see in the United States, because we see him as, oh, this evil communist person. You know, and it's just, that's totally not something you really want to be portraying. But apparently in Cuba, that's not a bad thing. That, hey, it's normal to see that down there. So you don't necessarily have the controversy in Cuba that you would have here. So even though it may be a compelling image here because of the controversial nature, would you say that same controversy exists in Cuba and in other locales with similar type of things abroad, or is that something just unique to specific areas?
Well, I think controversies exist within relationships and within context. So, you know, I'm a Canadian, and so, you know, my countrymen and I would view the situation with Cuba considerably different than Americans might. And again, it depends who you're talking to. I've had conversations with Cuban Americans that live in Miami that have very different perspectives on this. And so it's an interesting kind of thing, because your reaction to a photograph depends not only on the context in which the photograph's taken, but the context in which you understand things. So a Canadian will look at a photograph of Che Guevara or Fidel Castro and see it's potentially in a very different light than what an American will. And even more so in another country, just after we left Cuba on this trip, we were in Cairo for a little while, and then we went to Kathmandu, and I spent a fair amount of time in Kathmandu. I really love it. And they've had a recent history of Maoist rebellion. And so they identify very heavily with revolutionary figures like Che Guevara. So you'd be driving around in Kathmandu and see bumper stickers with the iconic face of Che Guevara on it all over the place, which is a little odd. So again, you know, the controversy comes from the context and your own emotional kind of connection to the issue and which side of things you fall onto. But I think what's important for the photographer is to kind of understand the context and the relationship, not only in which you're shooting, but in which people are going to look at these images. That's the kind of thing that engages people. Whether they like the photograph or not is really not my concern. It's whether they engage with it. And I think good art is, you know, good art asks questions and it probes, and sometimes it makes us uncomfortable. And I'm by no means a fine artist, or I'm certainly not someone who likes to, you know, to stir things up. Generally, my work is kind of, you know, it's a little closer to warm fuzzies in some way than it is to, you know, I'm not a hardcore photojournalist or even a documentarian, but nevertheless, whether you're shooting flowers, panda bears, or Marxist rebels, you have to understand not only the context in which you're shooting, but the way that your photograph is going to be received by others and read by other people.
Yeah, and I think you hit the nail on the head there. It really is subjective depending on the perspective. Like you said, not only the context in which you're taking the picture, but the context in which people view it. And just like in looking through your book, you've got just some remarkable images here taken from, I don't know how you get to all these places. I'm looking at these, like you mentioned, Kathmandu. And I'm just like a laundry list of places. Yeah, I'd love to go there someday. Just really some incredible images. Like I'm looking at one right now. This is on in Kashmir, India, where you had camped outside the Litter River.
Uh-huh.
And the shot of the guy on the facing page where he's got two teeth.
Yeah, did he even have two? I can't remember that second one.
and he just looks happy as a lark. Like nothing really is bothering him. It just kind of, it's not controversial at all, but it is very much compelling. And I'm just wondering, when you go out and you take these pictures in all these various different cultures of the world, what is it that makes scenes or images compelling for you to say, ooh, that's something I would love to capture, quote unquote, within the frame, so to speak? Like what draws you to actually take pictures? Are you looking for portrait work? Are you looking for, you know, defining the culture in some way? What motivates you to capture all these just incredible images.
You know, I'm not even sure that the question is what draws me. I think the question is that it draws me at all. You know, when I see something and I have that fairly internal reaction that says, ooh, look at that. Why I'm saying that and what particularly draws me, I'm not sure. It's something, whether it's a color or a line or a texture or just someone's really interesting face. That what's important is that it moves me, that I look at it and I do react. I go out looking for stuff, but inevitably it's not the stuff I'm looking for that I find. It's that serendipitous moment when I'm frustrated and I'm disappointed that I haven't found what I'm looking for. And yet, I turn around and there's something else and I go, oh, look at that. Most of the time, I mean, I could engage in all kinds of introspection about why I like it, but most of the time I have no idea. It's just, you see it, react. And that's the key, is that you can identify what you are drawn to. Because, you know, I mean, you go out, you could shoot thousands upon thousands of photographs every day if you shot just everything. I think if photography is an act of expression, and I know for some people perhaps it's not, maybe they're more sort of, they approach it scientifically and they just want to, you know, pick a favorite f-stop and buy their favorite gear. But for me, it's an act of expression. And I really only want to express the things about which I care, you know, things that move me. So
sure. No, and I think you hit on a couple of things about what can be compelling for a photographer. Like, I know when I first started out, and granted, I don't have the longevity that many people have, but I was very much focused, and I guess it's a bad choice of words there. Well, maybe it's a good choice of words, but I was very much focused on, like you said, the f-stops and the shutter speeds and the ISO settings and the white balance. And more lately, it seems like I'm looking more at the kinds of things you were saying, like looking at the light, looking at the color, looking at the scene, looking at a person's eyes, for example, and just saying, wow, that's a beautiful face. I'd love to capture that in an image. And it's just funny how different things can move different people. So I guess in that vein, when you were talking about the things that actually motivate you or interest you when it comes to photography, would you classify yourself more than of a, because you said you don't really classify yourself as a journalist per se or a photojournalist, but that it's just capturing moments in time. Would you identify yourself more as a portrait artist or as a travel photographer? Or I guess I'm finding it difficult to
you're trying to put me in a box, aren't
you? Well, what can I say? Well, it's just you. It seems like some of your images fall within, say, the portrait genre, and then others fall completely within, like, a landscape or a travel genre. And I'm,
sure.
You know, it's just, yeah. It's interesting how different fields can move us in certain ways, because I've seen some people take pictures of architecture, for example, where I'm looking at that shot and I'm saying, holy crap, how the heck did they do that? You know, and like you said, it's engaging because of the way the photographer captures it. But I think it's also always interesting to kind of connect with the photographer on some way, which is, I guess, part of the portion of, you know, why we have these kinds of discussions and exchanges, is to hopefully connect with photographers and just to hear from them firsthand. You know, how would you classify yourself if you had to pick one? Obviously, you don't have to. I'm not going to box myself in or whatever. But if you did have to choose between one or the other, would you say you lean more toward the portraiture or toward the travel work or the cultural work? If, you know, how would you, or what are your thoughts on that kind of thing, more than anything?
Well, I would beg for mercy and ask for for the opportunity to create my own category.
By all means, create away.
I think that if I were forced to, I would say that I'm a storyteller, and these genres are ways in which I tell the stories. But you know, if you look through my photographs, there are architectural elements, there are portrait elements, there are landscape elements. I am certainly by no means a landscape photographer. I haven't studied the discipline of architectural photography, so I haven't really boxed myself into a genre. I certainly respect people that know what they like in such a focused way that they want to study those things. But I've just always found myself on something a little bit... I don't know, maybe I'm photographic attention deficit or something. I just see things and, you know, oh, look, something shiny, and I go off and I photograph it. To me, it doesn't really matter whether it's a landscape or a portrait. It's lines and texture and light and story that I'm photographing. And so I wouldn't for, and you know, even the category, even the travel genre, I think, and I've ranted about this before, but I think travel photography in a sense, and I'm going to get hate mail for this, but I think it's dead or certainly irrelevant, because we're placed to focus on, you know, the fact that we got on a plane or on a train or something and went somewhere, and it becomes problematic. You know, I go out and I shoot in Vancouver. Well, is it travel photography? I live here. But if someone from Venice comes here and travels here and takes photographs, then it's travel photography.
Sure.
And I just think sometimes we need to be careful, because not that genres can't be helpful to us, but very often they can also hinder us, because we think too much within that box rather than saying, you know, what am I really interested in, and why can't I shoot something that mixes genres or ignores the genres altogether and just does something strange. And again, if people have to stare at it and go, man, is this guy a portrait artist or is he this? Or
That's funny. Well, and it's funny that you say that, because in looking at the expanse of the work, and to be honest, I haven't read all of your books. I'm only looking at within the frame. But in spanning through this, I see everything from portrait work. I mean, there's a shot on one page here of just paintbrushes. You know, the paintbrushes and the different colors and the tones in there. I'm like, well, that's definitely not a portrait style shot. And I think you kind of hit on a key aspect there, is that we, as photographers or even as artists, you know, don't want to limit ourselves to a specific categorization, because, like you said, if you get boxed in, if you're working within this tunnel vision, are you really going to be creating compelling images if you never venture outside the quote-unquote defined parameters of what others are saying, well, this is what's classified as portrait work, or this is what's classified as landscape work. So,
yeah, I think you can, though. I think you can create very compelling images, and there are people that have stuck very tightly to a genre. I'm thinking specifically of Karsh, who was one of my early influences, an incredible portraitist. And, you know, I don't even think I even, and someone will correct me on this, I'm sure, but I don't think I even recall a portrait that he did that was in color. You know, he was not only a portraitist, but he was a master of black and white, very formal portraits for the most part. And, I just look at things a little differently. And I don't know if it's a question of my generation or what, but imagine Francis Ford Coppola creating a movie with only, a tight headshot. You know, moving from tight headshot to tight headshot, you need the variety and the rhythm and the pacing. And because I'm interested in the stories, not simply in doing portraits, I want to do, all of that kind of stuff, whatever's necessary to tell a story. But there are people that specialize in a genre, and, that constraint, because creativity always happens within constraint. It, as artists, we like to say, oh, I just, you know, I don't like any boundaries, but the best creativity always happens within constraints. And if someone chooses that constraint, says, you know what, I'm going to shoot portraits with an iPhone for the rest of my life, then that becomes the area in which you work, and you will create compelling work within those constraints. It's just I've chosen different constraints, and you know, we all shoot for different reasons. We all create photographs for different reasons.
So does that mean you're going to be moving to just taking pictures with an iPhone now?
It does not.
Yeah, I noticed you got quite. You're a Canon shooter, right? I noticed in a lot of your references, you're talking about the 5D and the Mark II and all that.
So I do use Canon cameras. It's certainly not a sword I would be willing to fall on or a hill I would want to defend. Someone gave me a new D3X and a bunch of glass, I'd happily shoot on that too.
Well, gee, let me think long and hard about that. Yeah, exactly. And I think that's one thing a lot of people are starting to realize about gear in general, is that it really doesn't matter as much as initially was thought. That it's not so much, you know, the camera or the lens or the f-stop or the shutter speed. It's about the person behind it and what it is they want to capture and the message that they want to give back. And I guess that kind of is a good segue for us, because in taking all your photography and in capturing everything that you've done, I think you've also done a pretty good job in segueing your photography from being out in the field to being in the classroom. So, you know, and that kind of segues into this whole thing of these books that you're putting out and these workshops that you're putting on that I'm sure are probably pretty popular. I haven't seen if you – Were you, are you going to Italy next year?
I've got a couple of workshops, workshop safari in Kenya in January. And
Kenya's one I'm thinking of, that's
yeah,
it.
Yeah, but there are a couple in Italy and a couple more in India in the fall, and then probably one in Tibet that hasn't been announced yet.
Oh, I hadn't seen that. Okay, cool. Well, I guess that was the kind of question I was leaning toward with that was, in capturing the images, and I guess I hate to compartmentalize you and box you in now by saying travel photography, but in doing your photography work, I'll just put it that way, in doing your photography work and transitioning that from actually being out in the field and taking images to moving into a classroom type environment where you're actually instructing others on how to find engaging and compelling and, I guess, controversial images, for lack of a better, you know, find something that is appealing to you to capture and then share with the world. How did you make that transition between being a photographer to being an instructor?
Boy, that's a good question. I'm not sure because, again, it's, I think just simply by nature, the person I am a visual storyteller, which makes me a photographer when I have the camera in my hands. But I'm also a teacher, just by nature. I love teaching. I'm not extroverted by any means, but I do love being with people and working with people and sharing what I love. And so it always was a very natural transition for me. I spent 12 years before deciding to resume the idea of being a vocational photographer. I spent 12 years as a professional comic and doing comedy across North America. And so I like...
Really?
Yeah. So
tell us a quick joke. No, I'm...
I knew that was coming.
I'm kidding.
And, yeah. You know, and then I transitioned back to the thing that I've loved since I was a teenager. I bring with it that still that love for communication. Yeah. And to be with people and to make them laugh. And I think anyone that's taken anything I've ever done in terms of a workshop or, you know, a lecture, I'm pretty organic. I don't generally have a bunch of notes that I follow. I kind of teach from my heart and the things I'm most passionate about. And, my buddy Chris Orwick, who's just written a great book called Visual Poetry, he has this quote, and I don't think it's his, but he says, photography or teaching is lighting a fire. It's not filling a bucket. And I love that because it really encapsulates kind of how I feel about it. It's lighting a passion because if there's one thing we're not lacking in photography, it's technical knowledge. On the flip side,
right,
what we are lacking is passion. I don't care if you shot something at f8, f5, 6, f1 point nothing. If your shot is technically perfect, perfection seldom moves the heart. It seldom engages people. What we're lacking, and I don't mean this across the board, there's lots of passion out there, but in terms of as an industry, this focus on gear to the detriment of a focus on passion and expression, I think makes us all a little bit, you know, it impoverishes us.
That's a great point, and that's something actually was touched on briefly, and I think it was 2 weeks ago. I forget who I was talking with now, but yeah, I think you hit the nail right on the head here is that, you know, we really have moved away from the compelling nature of photography for more of the technical nature of photography. And I've noticed that that kind of transition kind of went hand in hand with the transition to digital. And I'm wondering if there may be some kind of association between the two there. Because when we were shooting in our film days, like I remember way back in the day, and I've told this story to my own listeners many times so everyone knows that I started with a Vivitar 110.
Nice.
You know, that was a film camera that my grandparents gave me when I was like 12 years old. And I just remember that the quality of the images that came out of that. And I would do things like I'd put sunglasses in front of the camera before I even knew what the hell a filter was. I would take my sunglasses off, put it in front because I was like, wow, that makes a sunset look a lot better. You know, and take pictures like that. And I've noticed that as we've made the transition more towards digital, that people are looking more at the technical nature of things. Well, you should have used this filter. You should have used that filter. Had you thought about going to F16, you might have had a greater depth of field. It's like, yeah, but look at how pretty the sunset is.
Yeah. You know what I think it is, Jason? I could be wrong about this. I'm not sure 100% whether it's the advent of digital. Certainly the advent of digital has gone hand in hand with the proliferation of information available on the internet and that kind of thing. And so maybe we're just talking about it more. But I think as someone who is really passionate about this kind of stuff, I have to continually remind myself that this is probably more about the evolution of every individual as a photographer. Mm-hmm. You have to begin. Yeah, you begin passionate and you pick up your camera and everything's smiles and chuckles and teddy bears. But at some point, you have to learn your craft. And
right.
I I think what it is it takes years to get through that learning your craft stage. We're knuckling down and learning this, and we're just not balanced people. We always swing from one extreme to the other. So I think during that time when we're so focused on the gear, it is the stuff we talk about, and it's easy to get stuck, and I think that's the problem, is this is not about mastery of the craft for its own sake.
Right.
For most of us. It's certainly not for me. And so it's easy to get stuck in that mastery of the craft part where everything becomes about the technique and the technology and that final kind of leap towards, you know, why we started doing this in the beginning, because, hey, I'll just put the sunglasses on front of the camera just to see what it looks like and to play and create and be experimental in what we do. I think we need to get back to that, so that the technology, you need to learn the technology so it doesn't get in the way, so that it's almost like a sort of a silent partner in what you do.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I don't think it's that, you know, we're just more stuck on it these days. I think it's simply that more people are doing it. The proliferation of information is so much easier to come to. And frankly, it's just easier to talk about f-stops and ISO than to put your feelings on the line and say, well, this is the way I feel about it. This is what I think about, you know, and then just to let other people feel what they feel. You know, and the forums are full of people that would rather argue about it than just be okay with their Nikon being as good as a Canon or vice versa.
Right, right.
You know, so it's good for them for having the passion. It's just misdirected. They should just go out and take the photo.
Exactly. Yeah, there was a great quote from Joe McNally, I think it was. He was doing a talk at Google, and one of the people that was listening to his discussion asked him a question about making that transition between the excitement and learning all the f-stops and all that to getting things down. And I forget exactly what it was that Joe said, but he was talking about all the f-stops and ISO and shutter speeds, and he's saying that's sundry stuff, and that there's a migration period between when it's in the front of your brain and moving it to the back of your brain where it's more second nature.
I totally agree.
And I totally dug that when he was saying that. I was just like, yes, that is exactly where I am. When I was first listening to that, I was like, that's exactly where I am. You know, how do we as a group, you know, encourage one another to get past that? You know, yeah you still got to know it. It's important to know it, but it's also important to see past the f-stop, you know, the shutter speed, the ISO, the white balance, you know, the f, you know, which lens you're using, Canon, Nikon, and all that. But it's just really, I find it's becoming more and more interesting for me to talk to people like yourself here today about what inspires you. You know, what do you find compelling in images? What do you think controversy is a good thing to introduce into imagery? That kind of thing. So it's more of these, I guess, I'm trying to think of a word for it, but it's like a subject you can't put exactly, just nail it down black and white. It's this or that. It's more the intangibles, for lack of a better phrase, that I think is driving a lot of interest these days, because I think people are starting to get tired of hearing about all the technical and all that. And it's the intangibles that people really want to hear about. That's what's really engaging and people find intriguing, because that is what encourages people to grow.
I hope so. I hope that's the case. I wrote a post very similar to that rant on Scott Kelby's blog a while back, called The Coming Revolution. And I somehow accidentally ended up on a Leica forum, and they were calling me a task and calling me naive and misinformed. And I have nothing against Leica users by any means, but this particular forum, there were a number of very vocal people, and I thought, you know, it's too bad, because truly what I was saying was not that I thought we were really moving into this coming revolution where people were going to start paying more attention to this kind of thing. I was really using kind of a rhetorical device and saying, I hope for the love of Ansel Adams that was the case. And if people could pick up that fire and begin to understand that we've got to the end of the megapixel race, and maybe it's time to focus on more compelling photographs and not bigger photographs.
Yeah.
And if that's the way that we can move, then that might free some of us up to, you know, to stop, you know, buying these big fancy lenses just simply to have them, and take out the crappy lens you've always had in the bottom of your bag and go master it. Go just see what the world looks like through that optic, see how it behaves, and create pictures. You know, we spend so much time talking about photography, it can become a counterfeit for actually going out and being a photographer.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's kind of funny you mentioned about the crappy lens. I actually did that recently. When I first got my Canon XT, what was it, 5, 6, 7 years ago, when I made the transition into the digital world, it came with a kit lens. It was an 18 to 55 millimeter.
Yeah, I think they're still putting that thing on the front of cameras.
It's a total piece of junk compared to some of the other stuff that's out there. I mean, now they even have the 18 to 55 with IS, with image stabilization on it. So they've pretty much relegated the non-IS one to not being in production anymore. And I snuck that out recently on my 40D and went around after a snowstorm, you know, in Denver area, and just started, you know, taking pictures and zooming things in and out and trying different things. And for being a quote-unquote crappy lens, I actually got better pictures from that than I think some other ones recently, just because I wasn't thinking about all the technical stuff, where I was just more exploring the creative expression side of things. And I think that's part of the key that I think we're probably moving toward, hopefully, as we see this huge explosion of interest in the field starts to wane. You know, when people, okay, yeah, now I get f-stop, now I get shutter speed, now I get ISO. Now what? Well, it's like, well, you know, let's try exploring some creativity. This is where workshops can help. This is where, you know, actually looking at pictures of others can help, kind of thing. And actually, that's kind of a good transition to talk a little bit more about the images that you share in your books and the workshops that you're doing. Because I've noticed, and again, I keep going back to Within the Frame because that is the only frame of reference I have. But did you go through, when you were putting this book together, did you go through and say, okay, this is a compelling image, let's put it in there. You know, this isn't, let's leave that one out. You know, what kind of a selection process did you use in selecting images for inclusion in your books? And do you use those same ones in workshops?
Yeah, well, most workshops I do are national workshops where, to be honest, I'm not really showing my work. We go out and shoot together, and then we look at the work that the participants are creating, and we discuss that, which is a little more, I think, relevant than looking at stuff that I've photographed.
That's very cool.
Especially as, you know, others have read my books or they've been on my blog for years and have had their fill of my images. You know, they're familiar with it. I would much rather discuss their photograph and how it does or doesn't express what they're trying to achieve. But, you know, in terms of selecting the images, the process is brutally painful.
it's always painful, isn't it?
In part because the books, you know, they're not coffee table books, where I think you could just curate a great selection of images. They're images that are specifically put into the book to illustrate something. And so then it's a question of what's the best photograph for that. And when I started with Within the Frame, and Within the Frame is my first print book, and one of the things that I was really keen on is other books have been made and their illustrations are put in there simply as illustrations. And I think if an illustration only informs and doesn't inspire in some way, then you're only filling the bucket and not lighting the flame. So, I wanted images that didn't just say, you know, here's a picture of a 2 teacups on a table and here it is taken at f2.8 and f16. I wanted something that illustrated it within a context that I like to shoot in, and because I want to read this book and be proud of it. But, you know, I took, I don't know, I think 600 data files down to the local lab. They made 4x6s of all these 600 images, and I just spread them out on the living room floor and, you know, started attaching them to pages. And wow. And it was just a painful, horrible, messy process. And, you know, stuff got dumped and pulled back out of the dump pile. And at the end, you know, because the book itself is, you know, it's its own tool, it's its own media. So you're not just putting a bunch of pictures together. You're creating something that has its own language. So you kind of have to be a little more selective. And then, of course, you know, you give it to your book team, the editor and the publisher, and they move some things around, because they're better at what they do than I am. So, it's very collaborative.
Have you ever gotten work back from the editor and you're like, oh, no, I wanted that picture over there?
You know what? I'm really lucky. My publishing team, I work with Peach Pit, which does the books that Joel McNally and Scott Kelby and Vincent Versace and Chris Orwick get. They're really making some incredible books over there right now. And they're very collaborative. So, you know, not once did they tell me to tone down the sarcasm in my captions. They really were. And so occasionally when they're doing the layouts, you know, they'll send a layout back to me and say, oh, you know, I prefer that this image remains uncropped. And other times they'll send it and go, actually, you know what, that image looks better cropped in the book. I might just crop it. You know, and there are photographers out there who say, oh, don't ever crop my images. And it, you know, it really just depends, because there are some images I will give them very strict instructions and say, look, this one can't be cropped. And then others where I say, it's not the crop I care about. If it looks better in the context of the book to crop it, then go ahead and we'll finesse it as we have to. But they're excellent. And my editor's so good. He's just this really collaborative person. And I expected it, my first editor. I mean, I grew up watching Spider-Man, and the only editor I ever knew was Jameson and chomping on his cigar and, you know, Parker, I need pictures of Spider-Man, you know. And so here I get this. I
love Spider-Man. He rocks. You know? And he's one of the best cartoons ever.
I get this editor who's, you know, he just kind of rolls with things. I'm like, you know, I thought your job was to bust my butt about this stuff. And as a result, it actually made the process of writing and building, the book. And the second book is coming out. Actually, it's at the press or coming off the press right now.
Oh.
And it's just been really, it's been a thrill to put these things together. It's not as nearly as painful as everyone makes it sound.
And you said, okay, so hang on. That you just said you have another book coming out?
I do. I made a tactical error this year. I signed a contract for three books within, by the time all three are out, they'll actually all come out within a year. So it's been a really busy year. And they all kind of are hung off this concept of, you know, photographing your vision, and your vision being a central part of things you do. So the second book is called Vision Mongers. And the subtitle is Making a Life and a Living in Photography. And it's about, pursuing your passion and, you know, taking a shot at making a living at it. So it's a little more rubber meets the road than Within the Frame is. And then the third book will be about, post-production, the digital dark, achieving your vision now.
Very cool. Very cool. Yeah. That's awesome. And I gotta say, I like how your approach to the whole thing is going with regard to, like, the vision of things, like, Within the Frame. Like, Joel McNally's book that he came out with on small strobe lighting, and of course I'm blanking on the title right now.
Hot Shoe Diaries.
Yeah, thank you, The Hot Shoe Diaries. God, that's one of those moments where your eyes glaze over like a reindeer in the headlights, and it's like, I had the title in my brain 10 minutes ago, and now it's gone. But yeah, The Hot Shoe Diaries was a great example of, like, one foot in the classroom, one foot in the field kind of thing, learning about how to light and different things to do when it comes to lighting, but it didn't really speak to the visual process, or excuse me, as Canadians say, a process, but sorry, just a little U.S. dig there for you. But anyway, his book didn't really speak to the visual process and what to look for in capturing images. It was more about how to interpret the light. So I found this a nice, but a different approach, so that when you look at all these contexts and reference them with one another, it can really help advance your own creative vision. Not only are you thinking about visualizing photographs, but you're also visualizing about how to light it and things of that nature. So it's definitely a welcome angle that I don't think has been done that I know of anyway. And granted, I'm not completely well read, but I think it's a really fresh approach that I know is getting a lot of critical acclaim. So I guess thank you for that. The one last thing I did want to talk to you about, though, because you had said this is your first printed book. Does that mean you're doing ebooks or digital books? Because I think I remember seeing something like that on your website.
Yeah, I've been, for the last couple of months, I've been working furiously. My life is full of books right now. And,
That's a good thing.
It really is, actually. And, you know, to go back to what you just said, I think the Amazon.com mentality, you know, with rating books and stuff, you know, it really assumes that, number one, the reader's expectations are the most important thing. And I think if you're a learner, you need to be humble enough to read this stuff and not bring your own agenda to the table. Obviously, we need to review books, and some are better than others, but a book like Joel McNally's, you know, both of his books, they were so good, and my book is not meant to compete with them. It's meant to be a complimentary voice that says, okay,
exactly.
In addition to what Joe said, now let me address this, and there will be other people addressing other things. This is not a competition. This is about adding to the, you know, to the library of photographic teaching so that we all can grow and get better at it. So anyway, to that end, yeah, I started doing these ebooks. They're 32 to 40 page PDF downloadable ebooks you can get on my website. They're all $5. Just as a way to, you know, I love the creative process. I love the writing. I love the photography. I love the design elements. And this puts it all into my hands and just gives me one more kind of thing to play with. And one day I started fiddling with this idea and, I emerged for air 2 days later and had, you know, created this first ebook. And I thought, now what the heck do I do with it? And it's actually, it's been really exciting. You know, for $5, I like to think that I'm giving people a ton more than just $5 worth of information. And there's creative exercises in the book to say, okay, now you understand about creating depth. Here's an exercise that you can try to go do this, you know, to work on these visual skills. So first is called 10. And the subtitle is 10 Ways to Improve Your Craft Without Buying Gear. The second,
I like that.
Yeah, the second one.
I like
is
that. It's anywhere. I don't have to buy new gear. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
The second one is called 10 More, and the subtitle, cleverly enough, is 10 More Ways to Improve Your Craft Without Buying Gear.
Kind of a pattern here. I'm.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah. The third one, despite my temptation to throw a number in it, is actually just called Drawing the Eye. And it's about using the concept of visual mass in both in capture and in post-production. And that sounds really eggheadish and academic, but it's very kind of rubber meets the road. How do you draw the eye of the viewer into your photograph? So that's the three that are out. I've got a whole pile of them coming out in the next year from myself and then some collaborations with other photographers who are experts in their own area of expertness.
Very cool. And we can find all this on your blog, which is over at pixelatedimage.com/blog.
That's right. The pixelated image blog, pixelatedimage.com/blog.
Okay.
And pretty much everything's on there. You can get to my portfolio and the bookstore. And there's links to, you know, my favorite photographers, people that I respect and look up to as I'm learning too. Because we're all on this journey, right? I think. If I could leave people with one thing, if you don't mind my little sermon on this, is the reality is, you know, the subtitle of my first book, Within Fame, is The Journey of Photographic Vision. And I really believe that everyone is on a journey. If you sit down and you talk to someone like Joe McNally, or you sit down and you talk to any of these people that you respect, and you look at their images and go, oh, if only I was there. Well, you know what? These people are also saying that. They're looking at other people's work and going, oh, if only I was there. And because our craft always is slightly outpaced by our vision. We always want more for this, because what we feel on the inside is hard to express using these limited technical tools. So wherever you're at, you know, by all means, look at the stuff that, you know, that turns your crank and floats your boat and learn from it. But, you know, don't ever get discouraged and think, I'm not there yet, because none of us are there yet. Right? Every time we...
What is the there? Yeah, exactly.
You know, Joe McNally says it's a journey without a destination. If you get there,
right,
and if you're really happy with your pictures and like, finally, I've arrived, then you haven't. You've stagnated as an artist, and you always need to be growing and changing. And with that, I think, comes a certain level of not only the desire to keep learning and keep growing, but a level of humility that I think infuses your work with something real and authentic.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And people have said that I'm too self-deprecating myself in my own work, but I do think a little bit, like you said, of humility in recognizing that, hey, here's where I'm at, here's where other people are, we're at different points of the learning scale. You know, it's not so much comparing yourself to others, it's more finding inspiration from others. And I think that's what sometimes people have mistaken my self-deprecation or, you know, kind of jokes to that end are leaning toward. It isn't so much more, well, no, I'm not there yet, because, like you said, you really can't ever be there. It's more about, I keep wanting to learn more. It's like, almost like a sponge kind of mentality, where it's just like, keep giving me more, keep giving me more, keep giving me more. And then when I do learn stuff that's more interesting, that's more engaging, that helps me evolve as a photographer, part of the excitement for me is to turn around and share that with others as well. So I think that kind of ties into your whole concept of teaching and spreading the love, so to speak, for lack of a better phrase. Because that is part of what I think can make photography as compelling as it actually has become in this digital age, where you get so many people interested. part of the way to stay engaged in it and to keep things compelling is to connect with other photographers, to share your vision with them and to learn from them.
Yeah, I mean,
so, well, listen, hey, listen, I really want to thank you for stopping in and spending some time with us here on the Learning Digital Photography podcast. The listeners don't know this, but you and I had conversed offline about throwing a book into the giveaway. It's very generous. You said you're going to be donating a copy of Within the Frame for the December giveaway, correct?
I will go one better. I'll give you two. I'll give you a signed copy of Within the Frame and the brand new Visionmongers. The minute it hits my office, I will have it packaged up for you.
You guys heard it here first. David Duchesne is going to be giving a signed copy of Within the Frame and his upcoming book. What was the title again, David?
Visionmongers.
Visionmongers. That's going to be part of the December giveaway here at Learning Digital Photography. David, thank you so much again for taking the time to stop into the show. We'll be back in just a minute.
Welcome back to Learning Digital Photography. Thank you very much to David Duchesne for stopping in and talking with us here about how to create compelling and possibly how controversy works into creating compelling images in your captures. And leading from that into the final segment for today's show, I do want to apologize for not taking the listener questions this week because we just simply ran out of time. I didn't want the show to go on for too much longer than an hour, and we're almost there already. So rather than take the listener questions this week, don't worry. To Chris, Ellen, and Hide, I hope I'm getting your name right, we'll get your questions next week because we've got another podcast coming out next week. It's almost already done. We're about 3/4 through getting that in the can right now. But I did want to take just a couple minutes to quickly go through 5 key items in creating compelling captures, because that's what the whole subject and theme of the podcast was to start with. And we also got into the subject of controversy in photos and how that can create for compelling images with David Duchesne. But David hit on 2 things. He hit on color and light as a way to create compelling images, and those are 2 key ways, because color and light is really what captures everything in your images for you. That's what people are looking at. They're looking at the presence of color or even the absence of color if you're working in black and white. When you're working with light, the same kind of thing applies. Photography by definition is writing with light. Photo is the Greek equivalent of the word light. So you're painting with light or writing with light, and the positioning of light, the presence of light, or the absence of light in compelling and creative ways can often create a definite response in how people view your images. So that's the second way in which you can create compelling captures, is to look for the light in your images. The last 3 ways are emotions. You want to try and capture emotion, especially if you're doing portraiture and people photography. You want to get some kind of emotion involved. You don't want people to just be standing there flat and looking boring. Capturing some essence of emotion in an image can be difficult, but it's also very rewarding. It can make for very creative and compelling images in that regard too. And one of the ways in which you can create emotion and capture emotion is actually by looking at people's eyes. And the eyes is 4, because if you're getting people's eyes in a shot, it's like the window to the soul kind of thing. So if you can see their eyes, you can kind of get a hint of what their face is saying, what kind of body language they have, and you can kind of just get a sense that way. So that's 4 in making sure that you've got the eyes in an image. And this is especially true for when you're doing portraiture work or if you're doing any kind of wildlife photography. I've seen a lot of avian photographers. They make sure the eyes of the eagle are in the shot, or the eyes of the cougar or the bear, or you know, any kind of wildlife shot, any kind of facial shot where there's a face involved, whether it's a bear, an eagle, a wife, a kid, or even a dog, a family dog. If you don't have the eyes in the shot, that's not going to be as compelling as it could be. And by the same token, if you can get the eyes in the frame, within the frame, so to speak, thank you to David Duchesne for that. But if you get the eyes in the picture, you also want to make sure those are sharp. Sharpness in eyes, or I should say lack of sharpness in eyes, can lose a lot of the compelling nature of an image. So if you are doing portraiture type work, regardless of what the portrait picture is being taken of. You want to make sure the eyes are in there and that they're tack sharp, because that's what people go to look at first, are the eyes. And then the last way in which you can create compelling images that I've seen a lot recently is in action, in creating the sense of action or movement or energy within a frame. You can create a lot of compelling images that way as well. And I'm thinking primarily of sports photography, things of that nature, fast-moving things, like kids running around even can be considered action photography. So anytime there's any kind of movement or sense of movement or sense of energy that you're getting in your pictures, and David Duchovny does a great job of this in his book, where you can see all these different elements in a lot of his pictures throughout, whether, and even in still lifes, you can have energy. One shot that David Duchovny had in his book that we talked about on the show was some paintbrushes. And you think, okay, that's a still life. How does that have action or emotion to it when it's just paintbrushes? If you look at his photo, you'll see why there's a certain amount of energy to it. And it's kind of an intangible thing. But once you start getting that kind of sense about how to capture images in that regard, you're going to see a lot more positive feedback. There's going to be a lot more of compelling nature to your images. So those are the five things that you should be looking at, or at least five of the many. Color, light, emotion, eyes, and action are the five that, and I had addressed this also over on the blog. So if you want to read more about it, you can stop into the blog at canonblogger.com. You can read about it there. You can comment and leave your feedback here at Personal Life Media. I do take feedback here as well through the Dig link. So if you click on the Dig link, you can share your thoughts there as well. The iTunes reviews, of course, are always very much appreciated. And of course, comments on the blog, you can email me. My address always, as always, is jason@canonblogger.com. Last little tidbit or nugget that I wanted to share with you for closing out the show is a little contest news for you. We are smack dab in the middle of the winter giveaway for November. A lot of cool prizes being given away, including a book from Matthew Bamberg from the last podcast show. You can find more about that on episode number 32. There's also a $25 B&H gift card being thrown in there, and there's a NAP DVD, just a whole bunch of stuff being given away. And the theme for the November contest is winter. So if you go over to the Flickr Photography group and put your winter-themed shots in there, you can submit up to three images, 800 pixels if at the largest, for the longest side, and 600 at the smallest acceptable image dimension for the longest side. So 800 to 600 pixels on the longest side as one of the image requirements. Make sure you're sharing your photos so that I can see them and I can download so the finalists and the winners can be posted in an online gallery over at the blog. That is the extent of any usage of your images, so don't worry. I know I talked earlier in the show about Toyota scanning Flickr images out and using them on their blog. Don't worry about that with the contest, because that is the only purpose that I use them for, and also just help to promote fellow photographers. So don't forget to get your images in for the contest giveaway. Looking forward to giving away this whole package of prizes. It's going to be a lot of fun. That's it for this week's show. You know the ways to get a hold of me. I'm not going to repeat that information. That'd be a little redundant, plus we're running out of time. I have like 2 minutes left, and I'd rather get this show finished in under an hour for the listening audience. So if you have any ideas, comments, or feedback, please feel free to let me know. And I'm including in that suggestions for future interviewees, if there's people you'd like to hear me talk to. As you can tell, I'm starting to get into some more thematic subject matter here on the blog. If you like it, let me know. If you'd rather I went back to the original format, let me know that. Let me know who you want me to talk to. Let me know what prizes you'd like to see in future contests and giveaways. I'm always for mixing things up and making things more interesting for everyone that's listening. Thank you all to everyone for listening. I appreciate you taking the hour to have me in your ears. And we'll see you next time here at Learning Digital Photography. Happy shooting, and we'll see you next time. Bye.